Hi, I'm Terry, Instagram's sassy sober mum. Welcome to my podcast, Sober Stories from Everyday People. Bringing you stories from people just like you and I, the aim of this podcast is to share our experiences with drinking and how we got and stayed successfully sober. Not sure if you know already, but I offer 6-week and 100-day coaching opportunities to work with me one-to-one each week. In these 50-minute sessions, I will be guided by your particular set of challenges and experiences and tailor a style of support that suits your life, your needs, but also covering many of the basics that you expect in sobriety. You will learn about why you drink, why it's hard to stop drinking, what you need to do to succeed, the science around cravings, poor sleep, managing your thoughts, and finally, powerful tools like reframing, taking back your power, implementing boundaries, and building self-confidence. In the 100 days coaching, you also get WhatsApp access with me directly for any urgent or general support outside of the sessions. Here's what Sarah says about the 100 days coaching with me. What have you gained from coaching with me?
So much. I can't even begin to tell you what an amazing journey this has been. I have gained insight. It's probably been the biggest thing, and how to cope, coping mechanisms, strategies. The biggest thing I've learned has been learning how to reframe, reframing situation, reframing what to do, you know, if those thoughts pop up. I did come to you obviously a little bit destroyed, or more than destroyed, and on the floor, but I knew that I had it in me to do it, and with your help and insights and strategies and what homework you gave me just made it so much easier and normalised it as well. If I had an issue with something, you were there.
It's so nice to hear that feedback, and it's just such a privilege to help people to feel supported on this journey and to see people flourish after the 100 days is finished is a really, really wonderful feeling. So if you're interested in working with me for 6 weeks or 100 days, please go to the website www.sassysobermum.com/coaching, and you can send an inquiry from there, or just contact me on Instagram or send me an email, whatever suits you the best. I usually open up my diary once a month to take on a new 100-day client. So let me know and we can see if we can get you booked in. Okay, let's jump into the episode. Hello, and welcome to Sober Stories from Everyday People. Today I'm chatting to Hannah, and she's in Surrey, and she's been sober for 1 year, 1 month, and 21 days, which is awesome, Hannah. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you. I'm very excited.
Oh, good. always love to hear that. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Hannah? What do you do? What's your family situation? Yeah,
so I am Hannah. I'm 44. I am a self-employed gardener, which I've only been doing for 2 and a bit years. Before that, I used to run my husband and I have a business that we started. It's a children's hair salon. So I used to run that for, I think, about 6-7 years. And then I decided to, we still have the business, but I decided to, yeah, just have a change. And you know, I love being outside and I love nature and I love gardening. So I changed my career and I've been doing that ever since. And the salon we set up, because I have a son who is 26, but he's severely autistic. And when he was younger, it was an absolute nightmare to get his hair cut, basically. It was, you know, really difficult. And with that in mind, that's why we set up the salon, for kids that have issues with having their hair cut, not just children that have special needs, or, you know, but mainstream kids that, you know, have sensory issues or just don't like having their hair cut. So yeah, that's what, why we did that. And then I have three daughters. So I've got a 20-year-old daughter, nearly 17-year-old daughter, and a 13-year-old daughter. And I like to, I do loads of things. Gardening, obviously, like getting out in nature. I love festivals, like music, that sort of thing. So, yeah, quite busy.
Oh, I am definitely envious of your career change. What a lovely thing to do.
It's great. I'm doing something that I love. I'm just coming to the end of a college course as well that I've done in horticulture. So, yeah, it's been amazing. Yeah, it's been really good.
Oh, that is so cool. And, yeah, it's very apt because I can see out behind you this back door with lots of trees and lots of nature. It's very inviting. I love gardening. I definitely don't have as much time as I want. I have great plans to do lots of things, vegetables. And
it's funny because now I realise why retired people have such immaculate gardens, because they have the time to do it.
Yeah.
Like everyone thinks my garden is gorgeous, but it's really not. And it probably won't be until I'm retired. So, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely, when I think about my retirement years or my kind of later years or the later part of my life, gardening is a huge part of it. So
it's like
I look forward to that, you know, because I know I just don't have as much time to do it now, but I find nature very calming, very soothing.
It really is. I mean, it's helped me a lot. Yeah. Especially, you know, since getting sober and stuff. I mean, I loved it anyway, but it's made me appreciate, just the world around us. And it sounds a bit cheesy, but you can just get lost, and you can just go for walks for a long time and think about all the crap that you need to, you know, think about.
Oh, nature, best medicine.
Yeah, definitely.
So talking about alcohol and thinking and kind of linking that in, take me back to the start of your drinking. What did that look like?
Well, at first, it wasn't really... Like, I've written down sad and lonely because that's how it got. It wasn't like that at first, obviously. But it ended up being, it made me feel like a freak, to be honest, because my relationship with alcohol was not the same as everyone else's in the end. It just made me feel isolated, which is what it's set out, you know, that's its job, isn't it? But it also, I think it kept me in fight mode, because a lot of the time I was in fight or flight. Mm. And so it kind of did its job. It ended up just making me feel, as I said, isolated, lonely. It was chaos. It was just manic. I thought it was organized chaos, but it wasn't at all. It just was problematic, just, you know, shit.
Yeah.
It was fun at first, obviously, because it does start out as fun, and as I said, it did its thing, and I drank for a purpose. I know that now for sure, and it kept me in that headspace, I suppose, of just fight for, you know, survival mode, because I had a lot of shit to deal with. But yeah, it just, in the end, just got crazy. Really crazy.
When you talk about that fight or flight, what you're referring to there is actually your nervous system.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's kind of like that feeling of always being on high alert. Would that
be? That's exactly it. Yeah. I mean, I had, when I was 18, I had my first child, and he was diagnosed as autistic when he was 3.
Mm.
I think after that, really, Well, it wasn't actually. It was before that. I've been in, you know, that fight or flight mode for a long time because the relationship I had with his dad was really toxic, and it continued to be toxic after we had him. And then, so then obviously he was diagnosed at 3. I didn't have any idea, you know, what was ahead of me. But you just kind of have to deal with it and go into that, you know, survival mode.
Mm.
But the drinking didn't really sort of start then. It kind of ramped up probably after I had, so Cam was diagnosed at 3 and then I stayed in the relationship with his dad for probably, well, in total it was on and off. It was very, you know, sort of on and off, but in total, I think it ended up being about 9 years. But then we had, about 6 years after Cam was born, we had Freya, my daughter.
Mm.
But even then I knew that it was, you know, it wasn't, the circumstances were shit, basically. So, yeah, we had her. And then 6 months after that, I really then just had to call time on it. I was like, this is just, you know, not ideal. It's never going to be how I want it to be. And that's when I think in my early 20s, when I was kind of like, well, I was a single parent, effectively. I mean, he was kind of in and out. But that's when the drinking probably started, but wasn't really like, it was for fun because I couldn't go out that much. I did go out, but, you know, I was in like a single parent's place. We all had our own flats, but we made friends with each other and we all had, you know, young kids and we'd go round to each other's houses and that was kind of like my first like mummy wine culture thing. We'd get cheap wine in, we'd buy alcohol and make dinner for each other and then just get absolutely ratted. Mm-hmm. And it was fun, but it was also really, really irresponsible thinking about it now. And I can say that now because I'm older, but you know, our kids were quite vulnerable. You know, there was a couple of us that had kids that had, you know, disabled really, and, you know, very vulnerable. And, you know, we used to just go and get wasted, but, you know, it was the way we supported ourselves and it was our outlet, but that's, you know, that's how, what we did. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's how it started. And then, I'd always drunk, you know, from probably the age of 11, but not all the time and, you know, that sort of thing. So, met my husband now when Freya, my daughter, was only, she would have been 11 months old. So, and then we kind of, that really should have been the sort of, you know, happily ever after, because my husband was amazing and he just didn't really bat an eyelid about the fact that Cam was autistic and, you know, and he took Cam and Freya on and, you know, we were a family and that was all great. And then we went on to have another, you know, our own child. And yeah, it was all great. Life was good. But, you know, Cam and his autism was so challenging, like unbelievably challenging. And we talk about it now, Doug and I, and we think, how the hell did we get through that? And we know how we did. We drank. And, you know, we used to go out a lot. We had good social life. We used to go to festivals, parties, pubs, everything. You know, we had good support network, you know, as in, you know, we could get babysitters a lot of the time. So we did that. But then also when we were at home, we still drank. And it was fine. It was okay. It was kind of what everyone did.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, I think the problems that we had with Cam and how difficult his behaviour was and how challenging, we just then just used to drink, and that's how we coped with it. You know, it was like a just coping mechanism, I suppose.
Yeah. And a lot of people will relate to.
That
when you've got challenges and difficulties, whatever they look like, whether it's work stress or family stress, homeless, being single, with kids, without kids, losing people, parents. Yeah. You know, it is the thing, isn't it, that does, in the moment, it does help.
Yeah. I think, though, because it went on for such a long time, and when I say it went on, what I mean is life went on, and life with, you know. So if I just give you a little bit of an insight into how Cam is, you know, there's lots of programs about autistic people, and they're brilliant, they're very informative, they're amazing, but a lot of them are, you know, people or kids that can communicate, whether that's through speech or through, you know, using a Makaton or anything like that, you know, or using an iPad or sign. Cam does have speech, but it's very limited, but he is not what you would see typically in one of those programs. So what I mean by that is he, you know, lots of people say to me, oh, has he got a special talent? And I'm like, no, because he doesn't. I mean, his talent is him, you know, that's wonderful. And, you know, that to me, that's his talent. But he is just very insular and in his own little world, which, you know, is very typical. But he is very, very difficult to communicate with, to... I don't find it difficult to have a relationship with him because I'm his mum and I adore him, but he's very difficult to work out and to handle. And, you know, he is just, yeah, very complex, very, very complex. And no day was ever the same. You thought you got some of his behaviour nailed, you know, and then out of the blue, he would do something that you would just be like, what the fuck? Where did that come from? Mm. You know, just, so it was always, just second guessing the whole time. And then we went on to have Eve and then Iris, our other two daughters. Doug and I, you know, together, we had Eve and Iris, and we had to try and keep our family as normal as possible, you know, for the girls. And it's kind of impossible to do that. Yeah. And you feel so much guilt and so much like you're torn between your children. And sorry, I think, you know, that's where the drinking really helped, because you feel so isolated. No one gets it. No one understands. And alcohol understands, you know? I think to the outside world, it looked like we were coping, and we were, but again, we were in fight or flight. We had to just do the things that we had to do. And yeah, I can totally see why I got into, you know, the mess I did with alcohol, because, I mean, my husband, as I said, we both drank. He has an off switch, so he could really take it or leave it. But, and I think also the emotional thing for me and the feelings were where I used alcohol, you know, I felt like, I didn't feel like a bad parent, but I just felt, I don't know, I suppose I didn't really deal with having, obviously I was so young, and also having a child with autism, there's a grieving process that you go through, because he's never going to get married, he's never going to have children, and that's okay, but you, all these things are in the back of your head all the time. And yeah, it just, it's, I think that's where the alcohol, you know, for me really was my friend and didn't judge and just let me do and feel, and it masked such a lot of stuff.
Yeah. And I relate to it so much because I, from a blended family point of view, you know, just focusing on that alone, if we take the disability, autism, push that to one side, blended family life, I mean, family life is hard, right? Like family, it's not a hierarchy, like my life's harder than yours kind of thing, but family life is hard generally when you have kids, like two people, they come and they, you have expectations and, you know, it's very different, right? So that is a big adjustment, especially when you're young. You know, I had my first kid at 35. There's no way I could have coped with a kid at 18. And you and my, probably with, you know, could have been the same, but you had no choice, right? Because you had a baby and the baby came at 18. But then in a blended family situation, there's a lot of complexities there. Very difficult to get, it's very difficult to work all that shit out, to be honest.
100%.
And you know, we're a blended family and I feel like we're really tight, but we work really hard, right?
That's it. That is exactly it.
Yeah, we have to work so hard. We have to graft that the complexities. And, you know, my eldest daughter has just been diagnosed with autism. I would say in comparison, she's quite low support needs, but she still has, there are still barriers in communication. And there has been, maybe that has put a barrier in that relationship between my husband and her. When we didn't know, you know, when we didn't know what was going on. And it's easy to see how complicated those relationships are. And also for me, like one of the things, and you probably relate to this, one of the things that I've found challenging is that sometimes when the shit hits the fan, you know, it does, you feel very in the middle. And it's so difficult because you love your husband so much and you, like, my husband is my favourite person and I want him to be happy and I want us to be, but then of course it's my child as well, or my children, and I love them with all my heart, they're my children. And sometimes you can't see a way through that immediately. Obviously things die down and you talk and you process and you know, and you kind of buddy up again and you work through things and you move on.
Yeah.
It's hard in those moments. Like,
I mean,
people don't get it as well. I think, like you said, not unless you've been there, I think it's difficult to understand that world.
Yeah. So we had that, obviously we, you know, it was very complicated because, you know, there was Cam and Freya's dad still, you know, it was a bit of a nightmare, to be honest. And, but then, obviously we drank through a lot of those times. So we completely neglected our own relationship as well. Yeah. You know, I've said it loads of times, but we were literally in survival mode and we thought we were like doing all right. And we thought we had a good marriage and we did, but we were trying to just keep our shit together. And
you're band-aiding it, aren't you?
Yeah.
Really?
And we weren't making time for each other. And, you know, our kids were our priority. And, you know, looking back, probably we didn't prioritise them very well because we, you know, I keep saying we, you know, my husband definitely didn't have a drink problem. He says now, I mean, he's sober as well, the same amount of time as me. But, you know, he could have just knocked it on the head like that. But, you know, I couldn't, and he probably carried on drinking because I did. But yeah, I mean, we totally just didn't make any time for, and I think alcohol really, really had something to do with that. I mean, if we'd have been doing all the stuff that we did if we weren't drinking, we'd have definitely, you know, paid more attention to what was going on within us and, how we were as individuals and that sort of thing. But anyway, it got us to where we are now. So, you know, it you know, it's really hard because you think, shit, what, how, why, how did we do that? But then, you know, we wouldn't be in this situation now. So it's a tough one, yeah. You know?
It is a tough one as well. But I think that, you know, it's difficult. You cannot underestimate a nervous system that's always on high alert. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people can probably really relate to that in their own lives. Just that anxiety. So many people feel anxiety, right? Like, just anxiety is a big modern day problem for people. And a lot of anxiety comes from a place of being in your sympathetic nervous system, which is high alert, you know, feeling, you know, nervous system under threat.
Yeah.
And how do you calm that down? You're probably not even aware that you're in
That's place. The thing. I drank for so long and I used to drink every day. So I would drink, you know, like, I don't know, not at first maybe, but a couple of glasses of wine at night. But then that just soon moved on, you know, two bottles of wine each night between my husband and I, sometimes three during the week, every day. And then sometimes at the weekend, it would be more. If we went out, it would certainly be more. But I had no idea about any of the way that I felt. I thought it was normal. Mm. But, well, I sort of thought it was normal, but I sort of didn't, because I used to cry a lot and say, oh, I feel like a freak and what's wrong with me, to my husband. And, you know, so I kind of knew, but obviously wasn't tuned into it. But that was normal to me. That was how I felt for the whole of my life since I was probably, I don't know, I don't know, early 20s maybe. And that was, yeah, that was normal. I, you know, I never really could say, oh my God, I'm anxious, because it would just all was a blur, just all.
You didn't know any different.
No.
That was your baseline.
No, exactly.
Yeah. I always think about that as well, because I remember I used to get a lot of, like, bordering on crippling anxiety after drinking or after.
Yeah.
But nobody talked about anxiety.
No, exactly.
No, that it was anxiety.
No.
And then,
no.
You know, I might talk about it with friends and they probably didn't feel anxiety. And so they'd be like, stop overthinking it. I've just got the label of being overthinker. You're overthinking things. Like, you're worrying about things too much, again, as usual. So then you learn to just sort of think, okay, well, this is, you know, I don't know. I didn't realise the label anxiety only really came into focus for me.
Yeah.
Maybe when I got sober, I suddenly realised, oh, I put two and two together. Like, yeah, that's anxiety that I'm feeling, that kind of thing. Worrying and stuff.
Definitely. I just never vocalized how I felt, really. I don't think sometimes to my husband, obviously, but not to, like, I don't think friends. And so when I was anxious, it was just always kept, you know, and it just, again, it was just like a normal thing. And like you say, it didn't have a label. There was no, like, you know, terminology for it then. It's really so eye-opening, isn't it? Like, now we know stuff much more. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much more information out there now. It's brilliant that you can even buy easily digestible books on your nervous system, for example.
Yeah.
Like, learn about this little operating system that's going on inside of you, and being able to recognise yourself and not feel so different, not feel like such a freak. And
exactly.
But also, I think it's so important to look back and find that compassion. At the end of the day, you were doing your best.
Yeah, completely.
That you didn't get a handbook on how to deal with, weren't expecting, and came with lots of extra challenges, really, in your life and in your family life. And so when you look through that lens, it's easy to see why alcohol became your friend, became a coping mechanism, until you wise up to it and then realise, but actually that friend is, like, it's not really the kind of friend I need, really.
No.
This is a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah. 100%, 100%, yeah. It's funny, isn't it? It's so bit of a shock, isn't it, when you actually realise, like, oh, okay, so you're not helping me out, friend.
Yeah, it is another shock, yeah. And so talk through that process. You know, what got you to the point where you decided to stop?
Well, I think the fact that I had, Cam, in about 2017, 18, we started talking about Cam moving out of home, and that threw up so many, obviously, feelings and thoughts. And then he ended up moving out, and so he lives in a supported living. He's really, you know, well looked after there now. But before, it was quite problematic when it first happened, and it was very traumatic for him, for me. He didn't understand why he was moving out, basically. You know, I couldn't explain to him. You know, one day he was just here, and then even though I tried to prepare him as much as possible, you know, in this strange place that he and I was leaving him. And so that kind of started, I think, my drinking got really bad then. And I think I had a bit of a breakdown, if I'm honest, because that's why I started having panic attacks, and I've never had them before. And then COVID hit, and then he was settled by then. But it was just, I couldn't go and see him.
I was going to say, you must have not been able to go and see him. That must have put so much pressure on you.
Oh. It was horrible because I could speak to him on FaceTime, but he can't really. He only says a couple of things. You know, he'll only say hello, or they're very, like, short learnt phrases, and he will repeat them all the time. And, you know, you can't have a conversation with him. And the way that I know Cam is okay is by seeing him. If I see him, I can get a feel of how he is, his behaviours, and then I'll know he's okay or if he's not okay. So I was really, really worried. And because the place that he first went to live in was an absolute nightmare. And I mean, it was bordering on neglect, really. I was worried that was happening again. So when I couldn't see him, I was just went into, like, you know, oh God, the worst is going to happen. So yeah, that was really terrible. And I was drinking the worst I've ever drunk. I was staying up till 4 in the morning drinking gin, falling asleep on the sofa. Just, it was horrendous. Oh. So then we got out of COVID, and it was all kind of okay. But then lots of other things happened. We moved house, and lots of other sort of big, I suppose, family shit just happened. And then my drinking just got progressively worse and worse. And I tried to keep a lid on it, and I tried to do all the things that loads of people talk about on, you know, here, like saying to yourself, I'm only going to drink red wine because, you know, white wine gets me ratted. And, you know, I just all that stuff in your head that you go through, like, I won't do it this time, but I'll do it that time. And, oh, it was just, when I think about it now, I'm like, what the fuck was I even doing? You know, rationalising it in my brain. And I would go out sometimes and I would be fine. And then I would go out and not expecting to get hammered. I would go and just, you know, black out and just have the worst time. And then, yeah. And then so I think gradually after, you know, lots of nights or times when, you know, I had nightmare drinking sessions, I was just slowly thinking, what am I doing? What am I doing? And then, was this the question?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
We're talking about how did you get to the point where you just said, no, that's it, enough.
I think I just had, over a few years, had a series of just getting into nightmare situations and getting so drunk that, just embarrassingly, like my kids, my poor kids, just the girls, I just know that they dreaded it, absolutely dreaded it. You know, we'd go to like family things with them, and you know, they've got cousins that are similar ages, so they'd all be off having a nice time. We'd all be drinking, and then we'd be, you know, getting home in a taxi, and I would just be unaware of what even where I was, you know, who I was with in the back of the taxi with my own kids. You know, it was just. And so I think I remember one night drinking wine in bed. It was a Thursday night. My husband was just about to like fall asleep, and I was up drinking wine, watching TV. And I just thought, what the fuck am I doing? Like, this has got to stop. Like, I'm just, I don't know, just, I'm not happy. I'm not happy. Mm. It's not making me happy. I think it is, but yeah, it's not. And I had a like massive cry to Doug and just said, I've got to stop drinking. And he'd heard that before, bless him. Yeah. So he probably wasn't like, he's always been really supportive. Like I think a couple of years before that, I'd said, right, I'm going to stop drinking. That time it was because I knew that people were thinking, you know, oh, she's drinking a lot. So I was doing it for other people, not myself. But this time it was definitely a, you know, conscious decision. And I just thought, I need to stop. So I went to bed and then woke up in the morning and thought, fuck, I think I'm actually serious. I think I'm going to stop. And it was a bit weird. And I felt really happy. I felt really happy, really excited. And then it was just horrendous.
Oh no. And so what, talk me through from that day. So that's the day then, is it? That's the day that you stopped.
And then I think I was due to go out with a friend. We went to this like Ibiza thing in London, and I didn't drink, and I was all really positive and really, and she's not a big drinker anyway, so it was all really good. And then I don't know, just I think the realization and the having to deal with, you know, my feelings and my thoughts and not having that emotional crutch and support and my friend to take me out of, you know, my own mind wasn't there anymore. And it was really hard, really, really hard. I was sad, I was angry, I was so mixed up. It was unbelievable. But yeah, I just pushed through and did it. I mean, I've got, as I said about Doug, he's amazing, he's so supportive. And you know, I don't know. I mean, I've proved that I'm strong, but I don't know, in those first few months, if he hadn't have been around, I probably would have cracked. I don't know. But yeah, I just took every day, you know, like lots of people say, you have to just take one day at a time, don't you? And I did that, and it obviously worked.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it was, you know, I don't want to say it was all roses, because it wasn't. You know, I was addicted to alcohol, you know, and I didn't really realise how much my body was and mind were so controlled by it. It, like physically and mentally, it was crazy.
And did that manifest in lots of cravings and just really strong desire to drink, or what was that like, and how did you manage that then? So I know obviously you say now in hindsight I got through it, but can you remember what you did to help yourself through that?
I think I definitely tried to distract myself. And I did all the things that lots of people suggest, like podcasts and reading and all that sort of stuff. You have to fill your time, obviously, which is, yeah, it, it's hard because time seems to go so slowly at the beginning when all you're thinking about is booze. And that's all I thought about. When I was drinking, it literally consumed me. I would get up in the morning and think about alcohol. So I had to retrain my brain, which is what we have to do, don't we? And I did it. I just, when I had cravings, I used zero beers a lot, and I still do now. I love them, but that's because I really enjoy the taste of something different to water or a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And I have definitely got into a habit, which is, I find it fascinating. Like, you know, it's when I'm cooking, I fancy a zero beer because that's what I did and that's what I do. Mm. So yeah, I used those and I just distracted myself and I did exercise, which exercise was not always like my go-to. I knew it helped because as I mentioned in like 2018, when Cam moved out, when I started having panic attacks, I started running, mainly on a treadmill, but it really, really helped. So I kind of used that and, you know, I'm not a natural runner, but I did that and I did cold water swimming, which is a really good, just things that I wouldn't normally do, which now I realise that, you know, the cold water swimming, for example, I thought it was really about like the dopamine hit and all that stuff. But also I've realised now that it's about, you know, putting yourself out of your comfort zone. I would never have gone in cold water. Even when I was abroad, I wouldn't sometimes go in the sea or a pool because I was like, no, it's too cold. You know, I don't like being cold, that sort of thing. But yeah, I realise now that it's about putting yourself out of your comfort zone. And that's what stopping alcohol is, isn't it? You know, it's proving to yourself that you can do things that make you feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
That you will be okay, and putting yourself in a vulnerable state and you can recover from that. And that's what being sober is about, really, to me. So
yeah, I think that's a really, really good point with the cold water therapy. You're essentially training yourself to remain calm when your body's in a stressed state.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like building a muscle. It's
exactly.
Like learning how to do in those moments of your body's under a lot of stress when it's plunged into cold water.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's really great. And it's amazing that you didn't at the time probably appreciate that.
I didn't.
Doing all of these helpful.
I knew it was good for you, but I knew that these sort of things would help distract me,
or just.
I don't know. And I was definitely looking because I need something I'm not like a person that gets a lot of joy out of the smallest thing. It needs to be massive for me. So I was trying to look for things that gave me the same hit that a glass of wine did.
Yes.
And I'd heard that, you know, you get this buzz and all this. So I was trying all this stuff and it did give me a buzz. It definitely did. But I think I've realised since I've stopped doing it as much, now I've realised, you know, the purpose of, you know, revisiting that sort of stuff. And yeah, it's just really interesting. But yeah, I read lots of things and I tell you what I just did. I had to just ride it out. That's what you have to do. You just have to ride it out because if you want something, and I really wanted to do it, I didn't think I did at the time, but I obviously did. You know, I just had to get through it and I just had to, like, you know, deal with the shit, all the shit that I felt. And it, you know, that's, you just have to, yeah, ride it out.
Yeah, and there is absolutely an element of that. You know, I always think about it like, it's like two train tracks that sort of start miles apart, but they eventually meet each other. And I think on the one train track, you've got all that education and, you know, podcasts and journaling and distractions and being very consciously competent at not drinking. Then on the other track, you've got time.
Yeah.
You just need to do it for a certain amount of time, essentially. And, and it's like eventually those two tracks, they meet and it's like, ah, okay, you know, and then you sort of get to a place where you feel it becomes more second nature not to drink.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, yeah.
But that time thing is, you know, I think is something that can be underestimated a bit in early sobriety.
Well, that's one of my, you know, like the you ask about the three tips. That's one of, that's definitely the first thing I would say is be patient, you know, because you think, oh, yeah, you're just going to feel amazing straight away. I mean, some people do, don't get me wrong, I know that they do, but if you've got other emotional stuff that you haven't dealt with, or you haven't you know, that you're likely to have, if you know the reason that you drink is because you've got other stuff going on emotionally, you know, that's not just gonna that's just not gonna go, you know, so you have to be patient and you have to work on it, which is my other tip, which was to say that you don't just, you know, stop drinking. You have to do other stuff. Like I've done breath work and I've been to counselling, and I did some counselling years ago, but I was never, probably because I was drinking, I was never really invested in it. But, you know, don't just rely on putting down the booze.
Yeah.
If you've got other stuff that you probably have, you know, got bothering you.
I mean, who hasn't, right?
Well, that's the thing. Let's face it. Yeah. If you drink, then you're likely to have some emotional baggage from way back when. Yeah. And you can't just expect to put the bottle down and it all be fine. So, I mean, I'm sure some people do, and that's amazing, but if there's still something niggling you and, you know, you're thinking, well, I'm going sober, but I'm still having these issues or whatever, you've got to do other stuff to help yourself. And it's really scary, but, you know, you've got to just do it. You have to man up, don't you?
Yeah, you do, yeah.
You do. That's, I think that's it, isn't it? You just got to face your shit.
Yeah, and absolutely, and I think it looks, and it looks different for everybody, you know.
Yeah.
What, like you say, I think it's probably unusual to get to 30s, 40s, 50s and not have trauma or, you know, challenges, emotional challenges, whatever. It'd be hard for you to not have that stuff, and that definitely comes up and plays out in sobriety at some point.
Yeah.
You know, that definitely comes into focus. And I know I had a feeling of, oh, I don't know how to deal with this. What is this that I'm feeling? I don't even know how I feel, actually. I couldn't label my feelings. I didn't really understand how I felt, because I think I'd never let myself feel anything other than alcohol-induced sadness.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what we were saying earlier. You know, the awareness, even that in itself is like, oh, okay. So this is a thing and this is what happens. And, yeah, I just never had a clue. I just used to, just go through it and drink the wine and, I don't know, it's crazy to me, crazy that, yeah, just that was the way that was normal and it was my life. And but you know, you only know that when you're out of it, don't you?
When you stop,
yeah.
You realise that you look at your empty emotional toolbox and think, right, I have some work to do here. How do I start adding coping tools, coping mechanism, you know?
Yeah,
I think...
As well, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say that I think this is something that pretty much everybody feels, you know, that this is a part of the journey. And actually, I do think that whilst it is frightening to realise that you have an empty emotional toolbox,
yeah,
don't realise it maybe at the time, but when you again get a bit further in, a bit deeper in, and you keep evolving, I think you realise that the process of building those tools is really where actually a lot of the joy and contentment is.
Yeah, yeah.
An empowerment of being able to start really addressing and fixing your own issues.
Yeah, I think it is liberating to, you know, think at the grand old age of, you know, 40, whatever I was, like, oh, okay, I recognise this. Like, you know, when I'm trying to sort things out with my teenage daughters and stuff, I'm like, okay, I'm actually thinking things through clearly.
Yeah.
And I can then go and, you know, go back to it and think, oh, actually, I'm this is how I'm going to deal with it, or I shouldn't have dealt with it like that. I never used to think like that, ever.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It's eye-opening. Yeah. And so aside from having a bit more clarity, you know, with your teenage daughters and things like that, what have been the real benefits of sobriety for you? Like, what's changed?
To be honest, I mean, I haven't touched on this a lot, but just gaining self-respect, to be honest, because I was a nightmare, an absolute nightmare, you know. I just didn't give a shit about my actions and all the consequences of my actions when I was drinking. I wasn't very good with boundaries, and I wasn't really shown how to sort of put boundaries in place for myself, I don't think, when I was younger. So I just didn't really have any for myself. And I think that got me into a lot of trouble. So gaining self-respect, and I think, you know, knowing that my kids and my husband are sort of proud and, you know, can see what I'm doing is, I'm making the right choices, basically, you know, because alcohol makes you so selfish, so selfish. And I was really selfish. And I just didn't really give a shit. I thought I did, but I didn't. So I think I've gained, yeah, self-respect, and just, you know, my family are, I think they feel safe now that I'm not absolute nightmare, train wreck. Because they just, my eldest daughter said to me at the beginning when I gave up alcohol, it's really sad. She said, and bearing in mind that, you know, she's most likely autistic too, and she won't mind me saying that because, you know, I know she won't. She said, I used to dread coming home, Mum, because I didn't know how you'd be, whether you'd be, you know, what sort of pissed you'd be. Because I could be drinking in the kitchen and I'd be fine, you know, that sort of pissed. Or I could be slumped on the sofa at 1 a.m. And, you know, she obviously, if she is autistic, which she probably is, she needs that
consistency,
and she was always worried about, you know, how she'd find me. And I'm not saying I'm on an even keel now, because I'm certainly not, but I think she understands that that's just me, and it's not because I'm choosing to drink alcohol over, you know, their sort of, over, yeah, being their mum, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's again, been eye-opening, because I just didn't ever think anything like that. I thought, you know, I was keeping them clothed and fed and, you know, relatively stable, and I was doing a good job. But really, you know, it's more, it takes more than that, doesn't it? You have to work on yourself to be able to help your kids out, I think.
Yeah, but you know, I think you have done a good job, and you've stopped drinking, and I think that probably shows a lot, and they probably means a lot.
Yeah, definitely.
You've still got, you know, your children are still young, you know, 13, 17, even 20. It's still young, and what they've been able to see is someone that was using an unhealthy coping mechanism.
Yeah.
And that person has stood up for themselves and stopped drinking and made a huge change for everybody. And that's something, you know, you can't teach better life lessons than that, really.
Okay. Yeah, 100%. I mean, they've all said it. I mean, they have. They've all said, you know, it's amazing, I'm so proud of you. But I think, like you say, that will probably go a long way, hopefully, into their understanding of, you know, how to deal with things and what it looks like if you don't talk about things or if you don't confront things. It's great. It can only be positive.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, to be honest, I think it's very easy for us to look back and be really hard on ourselves, but what parent doesn't feel that as well, you know, even if it's not drinking. Even when I have been sober, 5 years sober, oh my God, have I made mistakes with my parenting, and I wish that I knew 5 years ago what I know now, for example. And it's just like, it is always evolving, isn't it? You're doing your best with what you have in that moment, in the environment of modern life where we're all doing 100 things at once. It's really tough, I think, to be a parent in today's world. I mean, I'm sure it was tough in any, you know, generation, but we have a lot of distractions and stresses. And so do our kids, you know? So do our kids.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say.
Stressing about maths tests. I said to her, actually, it doesn't matter, darling. Don't worry about it. Just do what you can and that's enough. But she's putting that pressure on herself. She's feeling the strain. And so it's kind of, you know, when I look at that, I think, gosh, she's 8.
I know.
So I think it's, whether it was the alcohol or not, there's always reasons to, beat ourselves up, I think. But having the opportunity to be able to show, you know, for me, when I get things wrong with parenting, I always make a conscious effort to apologize or to explain myself. And I feel like that isn't a weakness. You know, I feel like that's such a strength to be able to say, do you know what? I got that wrong.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That is something that I've definitely noticed since being sober. And it's just self-awareness, isn't it? And again, like I said, alcohol makes you selfish, and it did me anyway. But I have, apologised a lot more since I've been sober, which is really, it's a bit sad, but at least I'm doing it now. And I'll go to my kids and say, obviously I've reflected, and I'll say, I'm sorry if I think I'm sorry. And so that's great, you know, and there's modelling behaviour, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think that means a lot, because you show your children that you're not perfect.
You're not perfect,
humans aren't perfect. And humans, God forbid, even parents and grandparents still make plenty of mistakes.
Yeah. And it's just life, isn't it? It's life.
Yes, it is. Yeah. So just give us an insight into I know you've mentioned a couple of bits, but what would be your main tips, your three tips for getting and staying sober?
Yeah, so just the patience thing is definitely a biggie. Just it's not going to be, you know, you're not going to feel... I think I really struggle with... I've got quite big feelings anyway. So if I'm really up, I'm up. And if I'm down, I'm really down. And I was just so hoping that I would just feel much more, you know, even keeled and just normal, in inverted commas. But I've realised that that's just my personality. And I was waiting for it to kind of happen when I got sober, and it hasn't really. But yeah, I just was just waiting and waiting. But I think if you are patient, you do see, you start to see, and it's not until you look back on certain things and think, oh, well, actually, you know, I am where I wanted to be. You know, I got to 3 months and I was really, really happy. And then I went down a bit. Yeah. And it definitely took me until 6 months to feel, I think I've nailed this, you know. So I would say patience is really, really important. And I'm not really an impatient person, I don't think, but I think I just wanted to feel better. And you're not going to straight away, I don't think.
Mm.
That's my personal experience anyway.
Yeah.
And yeah, like I said, it's just doing other stuff to work on yourself, you know. I think that's quite important, really.
Mm.
You know, using other methods of just tools to, well,
it's kind of taking, it's like taking an interest in yourself in a way.
Yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah. And just finding things that are, you read about lots of things that other people do and you think, oh yeah, I might give that a go or might not. And I think you've got to try things, because if you don't, then you're never going to know. And what, you've got nothing to lose, have you? So, and then, yeah, I spoke about it with the cold water swimming. Do things that aren't in your comfort zone. You know, I wasn't very good at that. And I realise now that's because I like to be, you know, in the safe place. And also, I don't like to be, not to be able to do something. So I just never tried anything new. And since I've given up drinking, I've definitely tried new things, and yeah, realised that obviously it's so healthy to be put into that vulnerable, you know, space that you think, oh God, this is going to be awful, but actually it's not that awful.
Yeah,
and I've been through far worse, and you'll get over it.
Yeah,
and you can cope with it. You know, I think that's really important.
Yeah, but it also feels like a victory as well, I think, when you do
that.
You give yourself an opportunity to show yourself what you're made of, what you're capable of.
See, I don't get that a lot, because I think my self-worth is a bit, very shit. And I still really struggle with that. You know, I don't get the whole... Like, my husband, he's amazing. Like, he's my biggest cheerleader. And he's like, you're so fucking amazing, Han. And I'm like, I'm not, though. Like, I'm not. And he lists all the stuff that I've done. And I'm like, okay, yeah, but I still don't get that, you know. And it's really, really hard to, if you're not that way inclined, you know, you're meant, like, your brain isn't wired that way to, but you just have to keep working at it, because if you don't, then... you'll never have any tiny little sort of, you know, inkling of how that feels. And even if you get a small bit, it's good.
I think it's interesting. It'd be interesting to talk to you again in a couple of years to see how that's evolved, you know?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I've done loads of stuff. Like, I've just done a triathlon. Like, all my friends are like, what? What are you doing? That is not you. Like, yeah. I've just done a triathlon. I've done a couple of like runs and stuff, and we did a cycle, a charity cycle, which was harsh. And like I said before, exercise was never really my go-to. And it just still now, I'm like Doug will say, or my best friend will say, you know, you'll get the buzz. And I'm like, I don't think I will. Like, I can see how it helps.
Mm.
I don't know. I think, yeah, it's, yeah, I've got quite a complex, you know, thought process. But yeah, in a couple of years, I can see how all this stuff has really helped me. Mm. But I still have this thing in my brain where I'm like, it's not really that amazing, really, is it? Yeah. You know?
Yeah. But I wonder whether, because I just think, you know, a year, 2 months is such an amazing amount of time, but it's still only a year, 2 months. I think that's the point. And actually, what my experience has been, and I do, when I do share it with other people, they do tend to agree, is that it's almost like, I always think at this stage now, it's like every year you level up a bit.
Yeah.
And everything. Yeah. You know, you fine tune
your
self-esteem and you fine tune your different abilities. And so it's almost like you've come so far already, but there's so much left in a weird way that I think it's about that having that, you know, it's like you just haven't got it yet.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like it's just coming, but you just haven't fine-tuned it yet. And sometimes undoing a lifetime of trauma and being in a difficult place mentally, trying to cope with a lot, just sometimes that takes, again, it's that time thing, isn't it? Take time to unravel that shit and rebuild yourself. You know, you've only just probably worked out who you are right now.
Yeah.
Capable of. It's a bit like, now I know where my foundation is, okay, what do I want to build on that, and that takes time as well. So it would be interesting, because I feel optimistic that, you know, like in year three or year four you'd be like, that thing that I felt then, actually it's got a lot better now, you know.
Agreed. I mean, it goes back to my tip that I just said, be patient. Yeah. I'm clearly not patient, am I?
I didn't want to point it out, but...
I clearly think that I should be some sort of... Yeah, I don't know, but...
Funny. And was that three tips or was that two? I can't remember now. I got so into that bit of the conversation.
I think it was three, they're quite sort of mindful things, aren't they? Practically, I just did lots of things other people do. You know, I know some people can't use the zero beers because it's quite triggering, isn't it? But yeah, just not... Your life changes a lot, but you try and keep it as sort of similar as possible. So if you can do little things that, you know, aren't too... oh my God, my whole life is going to be different and I'm going to change completely. But yeah, I think small things like zero beers and reading and taking up your time, because it's all consuming, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was for me, to be honest. Yeah, same. It was quite all consuming in the beginning. And I was quite laser focused on it. But I found a place to enjoy that. You know, I learned how to enjoy the process being sober. And I do think that really helped me. And I do try to encourage that with others now, rather than it feeling like a slog or like, oh,
yeah.
Do the things that you really actually like and read the books that you really enjoy reading. You know, if you're not resonating with the book, put it down, pick up another. Like, don't make it any harder than it needs to be. I think that was, for me, that really helped as well. Like, I love that. I think it's also a 40s thing. I did a triathlon when I got to 40, bought a road bike. Maybe it's like early midlife crisis or something.
But
I loved it. You know, I hope one day I do it again. I really do. You know, when I don't have a toddler and two other kids, you've got really young kids at the moment. But I like the idea of coming back to that. You know, I do think there's it's amazing what you can do when you just give it a go. But yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Sleep is another thing. I know loads of people say it, but I was just... I can't believe how much sleep I need now. I never used to sleep at all. And I was probably wired so much on, you know, alcohol and trying to keep, you know, everything going. I just didn't really need a lot of sleep. And I was quite famous for that. But I just sleep now all the time. And when back when I was, you know, first trying to get sober, I just went to bed because I was like, fuck this. I feel like shit. I'm going to go to bed and just do it. If you need to do it, do it. I mean, if you've got stuff that needs doing, like your washing or whatever, just leave it. Just go to bed.
Yeah, it's good advice. It really is. I think remember very much that going to bed early in the beginning phases. But also, I'm the same. If I get like my optimal is 9 hours, I mean, that's a lot of sleep.
I know.
That's when I feel my best. If I get less than 8 hours, I feel not great. Which
it's
is mad,
so.
It?
It's just.
I used to
so
literally
weird.
Be up until 6, 7 in the morning, and then like just go straight into parenting. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Like, what? No. How do people do that? How did I ever do that? Because 9 hours is my favorite amount of sleep now.
I'll stay in bed for as long as I can.
Yeah. Funny. Hannah, it's been so nice to talk to you and to get to know your story with alcohol and sobriety. I think you're inspirational and you just
think
really, really rocking it at the moment. Thank you so much for coming on the show and keep in touch. I want to hear about how stuff, you know, evolves for you. And
good luck on, you know, with your daughter and everything. Because,
thank you.
You know, I know it's really tough. And I think I said this to you before, but, you know, it is a bit like sobriety, you know, going through a diagnosis for your child or for yourself, like, every day is different, so you're not supposed to know it all, and you know there will be twists and turns.
Yeah, to be honest, it's so interesting you say that, because I feel like there's been so many twists and turns in my family life, but now I just feel like I have more context, which is helpful. We were talking about this before we came online about our own experiences with neurodivergence, and obviously my daughter's autistic, it's just been diagnosed, and I'm sure there's more things to come in the future, but God, I'm sober is all I can say, because I feel like, come on, we can do this, you know. You can find a way. We can always find a way through,
for sure.
So,
you'll be amazing. You already are amazing. So
so are you. Thank you so much. And all the very best. Good luck with it all.
Thanks, Berry. All right.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in being a guest, please contact me directly on Instagram by sending a message to @sassysobermum. You can also find helpful tools and resources on my website, sassysobermum.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and you want to spread the love, please like, share, and rate the podcast. I really look forward to next time. See you then.